Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Roddy Nickpour. Today, we take you to the Claremont Hotel in Southwest Harbor for a talk by James Warhalla. He's a professor of political science at the University of Maine. The title of his talk today is What in the World is Russia Doing and Why? Professor Warhalla takes a look at what's driving Russian foreign policy and how the country is defining itself in the modern era. The program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time, and you can find this program on our website, mainepublic.org. Just click on radio to hear this program again at your convenience, and you can access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. And of course, it'll be available as a podcast. Introducing our speaker today is Timothy Stanley, Assistant General Manager at the Claremont Hotel.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Timothy Stanley, and I am the Assistant General Manager here at the Claremont, and it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. James Warhalla, who is a professor at the University of Maine in Orono. He was my advisor in my time there, and he is the Dr. John M. Nickerson Professor of Political Science at the University of Maine, where he has served on the faculty since September 1983. His research and teaching interests focus on comparative politics, especially on Russia, Turkey, and Eurasia, more generally, politics and religion, politics and ethnicity, and political theory. He has published widely in these areas in the form of several monographs and over 40 articles and book chapters in peer-reviewed scholarly journals, edited works, and other outlets. Dr. Warhalla served as the chairman of the Department of Political Science at the University of Maine, has served in the Faculty Senate there, and including two terms on the Executive Council, as its vice president in 2010-11, and has served in numerous other administrative capacities. He has been a visiting research scholar in Ankara, Turkey, at Emory University, Moscow State University, and Baylor University. He speaks six languages, including Russian and Turkish, and reads in 10. In spring 2002, Dr. Warhalla was named the 2002 Distinguished Maine Professor, the highest academic honor bestowed on a faculty member by the University of Maine. And in 2014, he spoke before the U.S. Congress's Helsinki Commission on Human Rights on U.S.-Russian relations. In 2016, he was named the Dr. John M. Nickerson Professor of Political Science. So, guys, please give a warm welcome to Dr. Warhalla.
Thank you very much, Timothy. Thank you all for coming out tonight. Russia is always an interesting topic, and perhaps no more so than now, with Russia being in the news, either directly or indirectly, just about every day. I'll open my remarks with a humorous little anecdote. They say this is true, that when President Putin came to visit then President George W. Bush here in the United States, they went to the Bush family compound in Kennebunkport. And they say this is true. I don't know if it is, but President Putin was inside visiting with President Bush and his family. And outside of the compound were a bunch of American journalists, and some of President Putin's advisors were out there kind of milling around, just talking with him outside the compound. And one of the journalists asked President Putin's advisor, he said, could you describe U.S.-Russian relations in a word? And the advisor said, in a word, good. And the U.S. Reporter said, well, it's kind of a figure of speech in the English language. You know, when we say in a word, what we mean is like a couple of words. So the guy said, you want a couple of words? He said, yes. He said, okay, not good. So, well, U.S.-Russian relations were not particularly good in 2007. And they have gotten successively worse, progressively or degeneratively worse ever since, unfortunately. So that raises, it seems to me, all sorts of questions about what was Russia doing in the world. You know, we hear so much about them, you know, having allegedly attempted to influence the U.S. election, which incidentally they do in a lot of different countries in a lot of different ways. We'll talk about that. And that many have noticed, and on the basis of some pretty good evidence, that Russia has been particularly active in asserting its influence in the world, particularly since the return of President Putin to the presidency. of Russia in May of 2012. And again, those who have noted and sort of an increased Russian activism ever since that time, you know, have not been imagining things. As a matter of fact, if I may just cite a piece of sort of academic, quasi-academic literature called The Return of Global Russia, an Analytical Approach. It's published about 6 months ago by the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. It's readily available online. Just Google and, you know, go to Carnegie Endowment, The Return of Global Russia. It's about 35 or 40 pages long, and it's probably as succinct and a synopsis of kind of Russia's activism in the world, particularly since the return of Vladimir Putin to the Russian presidency in May of 2012. Well, we'll talk a little bit about you know, what is Russia up to in the world and why, which is the, you know, the main part of the title here of my little talk. But I want to first focus on these core ideas animating Russian foreign policy, and that will put us in a better position to understand not only, you know, what Russia is doing in the world and the way in which they are attempting to expand their influence, but why? What are some of the underlying reasons for this? Some of these are deeply historically rooted. Some of them are of more recent vintage. But it seems to me, and I'm not real big on power. In fact, I don't like PowerPoints and all this kind of stuff. So if you like PowerPoints, I guess I need to offer you an apology. But what I like to do is focus on what seems to me to be five sort of core ideas and that animating Russian foreign policy. In other words, to help us understand, what do they see when they look at the world, so to speak? And this is the approach that I encourage my students to take to understand how and why countries behave the way they do. I'm talking about the government of the countries. When they look at the world, what do they see? And it seems to me that these core ideas animating Russian foreign policy, we could discuss them in terms of five. So let me just give a brief synopsis of these, or brief summary of these, and then we can talk about them in maybe a little bit more detail. First of all, first core idea animating Russian foreign policy, and it really has been ever since the arguably the 15th and 16th century, that Russia is a major historical world civilization and needs to be recognized as such. In that respect, Russia, I think, shares something of this notion that's kind of embedded in the American collective psyche about American exceptionalism. There's something different about America in terms of world history, and you know, arguably there is. I mean, no other country, civilization, empire has accomplished what America's accomplished, you know, scientifically, culturally, and militarily, economically, than the United States. I mean, it's just demonstrably, it's easy to demonstrate that there is something truly exceptional about America. And there's very much in Russian culture, and there has been for a number of reasons, many of them deriving from underlying theological concepts, about Russia's distinctiveness, that Russia is a major historical world civilization. It's not some, you know, barbaric backwater as it is sometimes viewed by other countries, particularly in the West, and that Russia needs to be recognized as such. Sort of a very close corollary to this is sort of a messianic impulse. In other words, that Russia, by virtue of its role and place in world civilization and in world history, and also by virtue of its geography, that it kind of, you know, spans east and west and north and south, there's something akin to almost like the, you know, if you're familiar with, you know, Virgil's Aeneid, you know, the myth of Rome, that Rome was providentially appointed by God or by the gods, you know, to serve this civilizing mission in the world. And there's very much that kind of thinking, and has been for centuries in Russia. So Russia is not just simply one more country. So this is the first sort of core idea. And arguably this goes all the way back to the time of, you know, the 15th century when they overthrew that, you know, Mongol-Tatar overlordship of this portion of Russia, and then began the process of territorial expansion that continued for the next 500 years and did not stop until Russia controlled about 1/6 of the land surface of the face of the earth. Okay, so this is the first. Russia is a major historical world civilization. And why this is so important in terms of particularly this most recent incarnation of President Putin's activism, we'll talk about in a little bit. Secondly, that Russia, that again we're talking about here are the core ideas animating Russian foreign policy. Secondly, that Russia is more or less perennially under threat from various challenges by virtue of its geography, by virtue of its history, by virtue of its abundance of natural resources, that Russia is vulnerable. That may seem a little bit counterintuitive, I suppose we could say, or odd, perhaps, to us in the Western world, since we often view Russia as being an aggressor and or being a something almost like a bully, you know, in international affairs. That's not the way Russia sees itself. Russia sees itself rather as quite the contrary, as being historically the bulwark of peace and stability and security on the Eurasian landmass. And then, in fact, there's Russia that has been repeatedly invaded from every direction on the compass except the north, because there was nobody in the north who invaded Russia. And, you know, I could go on and give you a chronicle of all of the major invasions of Russia, beginning with the, you know, the Mongols and the 1200s and the Teutonic Knights in the latter or middle of the 1200s and, the Swedes and the Germans and the French. It's hard for us today, perhaps, to imagine Poland as being a mortal threat to Russia. But, we need to remember that in the end of the 1500s and early 1600s, twice Poland invaded Russia and burned Moscow to the ground. Well, they burned it around the first time, and it took a while to rebuild, and it was invaded again. In other words, this sense of either insecurity or potential insecurity is a very, very deep and pervasive theme. A little bit later on in the talk, I'm going to mention the three core documents of Russian foreign policy. Well, actually, let me mention them right now and then just in passing, but then I'll go into them in a little bit more detail later. But if you want to know sort of the Putin administration, what do they see when they look at the world? Okay, the first of these is called the Foreign Policy Concept of the Russian Federation. It was initially issued in June of 2000. It was updated in 2008 after they invaded Georgia and amputated two poor sections of Georgia. It was updated again in 2013, and then it was updated again in 2016. But it's called the Foreign Policy Concept of the Russian Federation. It's about 25 or 30 pages long, and it kind of presents this picture of Russia and Russia's place in the world. Okay. The second document is called the National Security Strategy of the Russian Federation. Some of you may be aware that the United States publishes this, every few years or so, the National Security Strategy of the United States. President Trump, the latest iteration of that was published by President Trump in middle of December of 2017. It's a 68-page document that outlines the strategy pursued by the United States government to, secure the American state, the American society, and so on. 68 pages long, and it touches on many, many different aspects of what is necessary to secure the United States. Well, Russia has a similar document. It's called the National Security Strategy of the Russian Federation. Theirs is only 29 pages long, but in it, there is a description of Russia's place in the world. Listed, there are eight things that they consider to be the major security threats to Russia, and I'll mention those a little bit later on in the talk, and so on, okay? Yeah, and then thirdly, there's most recently, incidentally, okay, is a document. It's only about a dozen pages long. It's called the Doctrine of Information Security of the Russian Federation. And this document explicates the way in which Russia sees itself as being vulnerable, okay, by outside powers, and they tend to be a little bit vague in this one. The national security, they don't. The national security doctrine or strategy, they're not shy about mentioning, NATO and the United States as being, major threats to Russia and Islamic terrorism and so on. But the doctrine of information security of the Russian Federation is conspicuously vague, okay, in terms of the threats. But in it, there is no question that they view outside powers as using modern technology to weaken, to marginalize Russia, and to keep Russia in a weakened, marginalized state. Okay. And one doesn't have to read too far between the lines in that document to see that they're referring primarily to, you know, the United States and the United States allies, as far as Russia is concerned, is attempting to weaken and to marginalize Russia and to keep Russia in a subordinate position. All of this derives from this centuries-long core idea that Russia is vulnerable, and it must maintain vigilance and strength pretty much at all costs. That Russia, second core idea, once again, that Russia is more or less perennially under threat from numerous challenges by virtue of its geography, by virtue of its history, and by virtue of its abundant natural resources. Third core idea, that Russia is and should be recognized as a great power in a what they call a multipolar polycentric world. As far as Russia is concerned, the problem from which many, many other problems derive in the contemporary world is the tendency for the United States and its allies to behave as if the world kind of belongs to them, and if everybody would just kind of go along, then everybody would be happy. What Russia calls this unipolarism of the United States, this post-Cold War triumphalism, as far as Russia is concerned, is one of the main problems in the world. And a core idea animating Russian foreign policy is the notion that the world, in fact, empirically is and should be a multipolar, polycentric, as they call it, world. In other words, a multiplicity of kind of centers of power, among which is Russia, okay, playing a rightful role in place, as opposed to being in this subordinate position to the Western world. Okay, so it's a third core idea. But in any case, Russia is a great power. It seems to me that the first iteration of the foreign policy concept of the Russian Federation that President Putin issued in June of 2000, which was just about a month after he was inaugurated. They had the election in March of 2000. I mean, he was acting president since January 1st of 2000 because President Boris Yeltsin resigned on the last day of December of 1999, according to the Russian Constitution. You know, the prime minister, who was Putin, you know, then becomes the acting president. So they had an election in March, and he was inaugurated in May. 1 month later, he issued this foreign policy concept. Again, it was about a 25-page document outlining the Putin administration's vision for Russia's place and role in the world. And you say, well, you know, these policy statements, they don't really mean much. Well, one can look at that foreign policy concept that President Putin issued in June of 2000 and look at Russia's subsequent behavior for the next 10 or 15 years, and there's a very, very close connection. Okay, and one of the core ideas in that foreign policy concept was the notion that Russia is a great power, needs to be recognized by the rest of the world as a great power, was ignominiously humiliated by the Western world after the collapse of the USSR, as opposed to having been treated, respectfully and as it should have been, and that in any case Russia was weak by the end of the 1990s. The Chechen War had reignited the Russian state was all but insolvent in terms of its incapacity to generate enough revenue to make the government solvent. Russia was very, very weak and marginalized by the end of the 1990s. And President Putin made clear that one of the major goals of Russia, as enunciated first of all in that 2000 foreign policy concept, and then in subsequent iterations of that document, that one of the core goals or ideas would be to restore Russia as a great power, not to, you know, replace the United States in a unipolar world, but to restore Russia's place as a great power in a truly multipolar, polycentric world.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. James Warhala is a political scientist with the University of Maine. He's talking about Russia's status as a major world power, arguably equal to the United States.
Fourthly, okay, that another core idea, and this may seem strange to us here in the United States, but the fourth core idea animating Russian foreign policy, and this will become clear, I think, as I take a little bit of a look at the contents of some of these documents. Fourthly, that Russia is a democratically based republic, as opposed, and not a monarchy, nor a vanguard-led party. You know, in other words, back in the days of the Communist Party, when it was led by the Communist Party from 1917 until 1990, in which, you know, you had this small party, a vanguard part, elitist kind of party, you know, the Bolshevik Party, or that renamed itself the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, and that, you know, that ruled in this kind of paternalistic, quasi-autocratic fashion, you know, that according to the Russian leadership, Russia today is it's a democratically based republic. Now, it's a different kind of democracy than what we've got here in the Western world, and we might, you know, tend to just kind of shrug that off, but, you know, it's a good idea to, or it seems to me good to remember that, you know, even in Aristotle's Politics, for example, okay, that cornerstone of so much of our political thinking in the Western world, you know, that Aristotle talks about, you know, four different types of democracy, of course, and democracy can, this thing that we call democracy can take many different manifestations. But one of Russia's ideas, the core idea animating their foreign policy, is that Russia underwent this terrible experience of communist tyranny for 74 years, and that, in fact, Russia is building an increasingly democratic society today, and the expression of that, the foreign policy, or the outworking of Russian foreign policy, is designed, among other things, to help strengthen that process of consolidating, Russia's own form of democracy, which differs from democracy in the Western world. Again, that may seem almost like a discordant idea to us here in the Western world, but it seems to me that it's useful to bear that in mind. It is one of the core ideas animating their foreign policy. Their particular type of democracy, by the way, they call it sovereign democracy. It was developed by a fellow by the name of Vladislav Surkov, who was president what Karl Rove was to President George W. Bush, right? You all remember him, right? Right, yeah. Well, okay, you all remember Karl Rove. Well, what Karl Rove, or who and what Karl Rove was to President George W. Bush, that's kind of what Vladislav Surkov was to President Vladimir Putin. He was kind of his theorist, his strategist, his brain trust, if you will, so to speak, for better or for worse. And it was Surkov who came up with this idea of sovereign democracy, okay? In other words, kind of a democracy from the top down as opposed to the bottom up. Okay, another idea, core idea of, in fact, in some respects, this is kind of the foundation of all of these, maybe one, but certainly point number five. Point number five, that Russian foreign policy is animated by this idea, and this is kind of I apologize because it sounds like an academic, rather pedantic mouthful of words, but it's what they call a multi-vectored Eurasianism. Well, what the heck does that mean? Okay, multi-vectored Eurasianism. This came about pretty much in the second half of the 1990s, where by that time, and specifically about 1995, 1996, that then President Boris Yeltsin's decidedly pro-Western orientation, right, had pretty much run its course within the Russian leadership, and they were beginning to take a very, very different turn in terms of their foreign policy disposition. There were a number of manifestations of this, perhaps the clearest of which was the appointment of a new foreign minister of the Russian Federation, a guy by the name of Yevgeny Primakov. And his whole idea was that, and this has been pretty much pursued ever since, although with some modifications that we'll talk about in a little bit, that Primakov's idea was that rather than tethering Russia's future to the Western world, right, in other words, increasing economic ties and political ties and closer and closer ties with the Western world, that really wasn't working that very well for Russia, because what it was doing is just putting Russia in this increasingly kind of subordinate position to the Western world. Primakov and Primakov's idea, and subsequently this idea of sort of multi-vectored Eurasianism, the idea was that Russian foreign policy should be differentiated so as to have a different sort of character, depending upon which particular geographical vector you were dealing with. So, but the idea of this Eurasian, what they called Eurasianism, what did that mean, and what does it mean today? Well, there are many different sort of stripes and variants of Eurasianism, just as there are many different stripes and dimensions, one could say, of conservatism. A lot of people are politically conservative, but not everybody's a member of the Tea Party, for example, so to speak, or that wing of the Republican Party. In the same way in Russia, this Eurasianism had a number of different stripes. But the whole idea was that immediately after the collapse of the USSR by the end of 1991, President Boris Yeltsin's disposition to kind of tether Russia's hopes for development and moving beyond the maladaptiveness of the communist economic system and the dysfunctions of that tyrannical mode of government that they had under the Communist Party, that tethering Russia's hopes for moving beyond all that, tethering their hopes with the Western world was just not such a good idea, that Russia kind of needed to find its own way. And in a word, the expression of that was what they call this Eurasianism. In other words, that Russia would kind of go back to this deeply rooted, long-term historical orientation of strengthening itself from within, serving as a bulwark for peace and stability and security within the Eurasian landmass, and that they would have a certain type of relations with the Western world, certain type of relations, with South Asia, India, for example, and Pakistan, a different type with East Asia that was socioeconomically far more developed than Russia was, and a different kind of relation, say with Africa and so on. In other words, a much more variegated sort of approach rather than just slavishly adopting essentially a pro-Western orientation. This is sometimes referred to as Eurasianism, and by virtue of its geographical expanse, by virtue of its just the grandness of Russian civilization, in world history, that Russia would become, the predominant force, if you will, not only politically and militarily, but also morally as well, I suppose we could say. They certainly say it and are not shy about it, that Russia would become this predominant force in Eurasia, not as a bullying dictatorial force, but just as kind of a ballast, if you will, for human civilization to advance. Again, it's not the image that we often have of Russia in the Western world, but again, it's one of the at the foundation, one could say, of this core idea of Russian foreign policy in the contemporary period. Okay, well, if this is the case, if there are these core ideas sort of animating Russian foreign policy, that kind of brings us back to this question of, what is Russia up to in the world? Or to use the words of our friends down at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, the return of global Russia. Okay, the return of global Russia. In other words, this increasing assertiveness of Russia, particularly since the return of Vladimir Putin to the Russian presidency in May of 2012. What is Russia up to in the world? Well, in a few words, I won't say in a word, but in a few words, okay, what Russia is up to in the world is, and they're very forthright about this, and there's nothing furtive or secretive about it at all. What they're up to in the world is advancing Russian influence, okay, anywhere and everywhere that they can. And in some respects, that does mean undercutting the influence of the Western world, because as far as Russia is concerned, the Western world led, and when they say the Western world, that's sometimes code language for Uncle Sam in the United States, but I think they should be taken literally when they say, the Western world, that the Western world just has this sort of hegemonic kind of chokehold over the world economy and so much of world politics in a way that doesn't necessarily serve the rest of the world particularly well. I'm not saying I hold that view. I'm saying that's pretty much the Russian view. So what are they up to in terms of advancing their own interests, or this this return of Russia, or an activist, some would say adventurous, Russian foreign policy? What sort of things have they been up to, and why? But there's a book published, actually it's in its fourth edition. It's called Russia's Foreign, it's a Russian-American scholar. He's a Russian guy, but he left Russia and came to the United States, and he's a professor out in California. His name is Andrei Tsigankov. And Russia's Foreign Policy, Change and Continuity in National Identity. And, here's a picture of, of Alexander Nevsky way back in the 1200s, doing battle with the Teutonic Knights, and the idea is that there are certain historical continuities in terms of Russian foreign policy, despite even major changes in regime type. In other words, it was under the czars for centuries and centuries, and there was under 74 years of rule by the Communist Party. And then, since the end of 1991, that Russia has been a, at least on paper, constitutionally based sort of democratic federal republic. Very different types of regimes. Okay, here's what Tsigankov has done. Okay, according to Tsigankov, to make sense of Russian foreign policy and what they're doing in the world, okay, we need to understand these different sort of orientations. And according to him, that these different major orientations, okay, and these aren't political parties, they're not interest groups or anything, they're sort of general orientations in the same way that, we could, the supporters, for example, of President Donald Trump, they tend to view the world a little bit differently, a lot differently, okay, than the supporters of, say, Hillary Rodham Clinton, right? Okay, yeah. Well, there's an equally stark difference among these different orientations within not only Russian society and what we might call opinion leaders, but even within governmental officials as well. And that these general orientations go way back in history, and that they, there's some degree of overlap among them, but there's really more tension than there is overlap. And these orientations at the top of this page there, the Westernizers, okay? There is today, and there always has been in Russia, ever since, you could say ever since 1054 when the Russian Orthodox Church split with the Western Church, right, and they mutually anathematized each other. But there are those in Russia who argue that, Russia is part of this broad-scale European Christian civilization, and Russia just kind of lost out on these major formative events in the formation of the Western world, specifically the Renaissance of the 13th and 14th and 15th centuries, the Protestant Reformation and the Enlightenment, that Russia just kind of got left out of those things. But nonetheless, Russia's still at root part of this Christian European civilization. This, incidentally, was very much the orientation of Mikhail Gorbachev, who was the last leader of the USSR, and in some respects, the orientation of Boris Yeltsin himself. The Westernizers, those who say, the Western world is prosperous, democratic, right, both on paper and pretty much in actual reality, respects human rights and so on. That's worked for the Western world, and that's the direction that Russia ought to move as well. The Westernizers, okay? Probably the classic example in Russia is a scholar by the name of, a woman by the name of Lilia Shevtsova. Brilliant scholar. She's written stacks of books. This one's called Lonely Power, and there's a subtitle in here, something. Why Russia has failed to become the West, and the West is weary of Russia, okay? But according to Professor Shevtsova, she's just a specimen sample of a Westernizer, that everything that's wrong with Russia, or problems they have, is that they're not enough like the Western world, right? Okay, there are these Westernizers, and they've been around for a long, long time. And it manifests itself again and again and again. Then there are the statists, okay? Those who, according to Tsigankov, have this view that what Russia needs and what made Russia great ever since it overthrew that those Mongol Tatars who occupied Russia for centuries, and they overthrew them towards the end of the 1400s. And the reason that they did so is that those Russian czars, beginning with Tsar, Alexei III in the 1400s, and Ivan the Terrible and Peter the Great and so on, is because what they focused on was building state power, the military and the economic capacity of the Russian state to marshal resources and to project it onto the rest of the world. Putin, according to our friend Andrei Tsigankov, who authored this book, Putin is, he's the concrete manifestation of this statist orientation, okay? And I think Tsigankov is correct on this. And then you've got what he calls the civilizationalists, okay? And, these manifest themselves in different sort of ways. You know, he's got this Primakov, this is the Primakov that I mentioned earlier, great power balancing and so on. The idea there was that, Russia is part of this, grand scale world civilization, and that Russia is kind of a leading element or force for advancing human civilization. And yes, Russia needs to be strong. Russia certainly does not need to be copying the Western world. In fact, what Russia needs to be doing is safeguarding and advancing its own uniqueness. Arguably, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, okay, would have come under this category of the kind of a civilizationalist in terms of way Russia should dispose itself to the outside world. The current leadership of the Russian Orthodox Church, and again, that's a whole topic we could get into, but there won't be nearly enough time to get into that tonight. In terms of their vision for Russia's place in the world, would come under, at least in my opinion, something like the civilizationist category. But Putin comes under the category of the statist, and that comes through again and again and again in every single one of these three documents that I mentioned earlier: the foreign policy concept of the Russian Federation in its four iterations, the national security strategy of the Russian Federation, the doctrine of information security of the Russian Federation, in other words, that Russia's, has a special role and place in the world, but it's under the most insidious and nefarious kind of attacks, okay, particularly from the Western world, to weaken it and to undermine it and to bring about regime change in Russia to make it more like the Western world. Okay. Yeah. And the remedy for that, according to Vladimir Putin, is to have this strong, powerful Russian state that basically needs to do whatever it needs to do to counter these nefarious external forces. Okay. Well, that brings us back to this question of what is Russia doing in the world, and what is it up to?
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. We're at the Claremont Hotel in Southwest Harbor. James Warhala is discussing Russia's modern foreign policy.
To understand what Russia is doing in the world, it's important to understand just a couple of just basic facts about kind of the economic situation of Russia. When Mikhail Gorbachev, he was the leader of the USSR from March of 1985 until the time he stepped down on Christmas Day, December 25th of 1991. He was the leader of the USSR. Okay, his job, his title was the General Secretary of the Communist Party, but he was the supreme leader in the USSR, Gorbachev. Okay, and his the idea of Gorbachev was to bring about a radical transformation of the economy and of society that he called perestroika, okay, which there's no exact equivalent in the English language, but it means sort of like restructure. I mean, literally what it means is rebuilding. Pere means like an iterative, and stroy means like to build. Perestroika means like to rebuild. Rebuilding of the economy. It didn't work. Some of Gorbachev's reforms did work. He did democratize the country. The elections they had in Russia in 1988, 1989, 1990, 91 were some of the most democratic. In fact, they were arguably the most democratic elections Russia has ever had in its 1,000-year history. His economic plans, however, were catastrophic for Russia. In fact, there's, you know, he won the Nobel Prize for peace. And one of the jokes in Russia, those Russians, they got all kinds of jokes. You know, they joke about these things, I guess, just to make their life tolerable or something. You know, one of the jokes is that, you know, they gave him the Nobel Peace Prize, but they damn sure didn't give him the Nobel Prize for economics. Okay. And, you know, the fact of the matter was that from the time that those economic reforms of Gorbachev were put into effect in 1988 and 1989, from that time until 1999, a period of about 10 years, the Russian economy was in a recessionary mode, of which recession, depression, you know, how do you define those two or distinguish between those two? The Russian economy was in severe recession every single quarter with the exception of two for 10 years straight. Can you imagine a situation if the U.S. economy were in recession for 10 years straight, one quarter after another, after another, after another? Industrial production, for example, in Russia, and we're talking about just the Russian portion of the former USSR, was something like only 40% in 1999, when Putin became prime minister in August of 1999, of what it had been 10 years earlier when those perestroika reforms. Trying to imagine, you know, the U.S. economy shrinking by more than, you know, in a period of 10 years. It would be absolutely catastrophic. And the point is that as far as Putin was concerned, okay, the core of the problem was that Russian state during the 1990s under Yeltsin, yes, in some ways it had become democratized, but it was a very weak state. It's a very weak state. In fact, one of the major reasons for the financial crisis in Russia in 1998 was that the Russian state was just, it was incapable of definitively ending the Chechen insurgency. It was incapable of dealing with organized crime, and it was incapable of even extracting enough taxation resources from the population in order to make that state solvent. Something had to be done. Russia was in as grave and mortal a danger as it had been back in the end of the 1500s and early 1600s when Poland was invading it and burning Moscow to the ground, or when the Mongols invaded and so on. Okay, Putin's remedy for that was to build up the power of this Russian state. So that pretty, in terms of both domestic policy and also in terms of his foreign policy, that puts Putin pretty much in the squarely in the camp of these statists. Okay, well, Russia's more recent activism. Again, one needs to understand that by the end of the 1990s, Russia was in just about every measure of state strength was very, very weak. That all began to change under the leadership of Vladimir Putin. The average annual growth rates in Russia from about 1999 until about 2013, 2014 were somewhere between 7 and 8%. You know, those are just astonishingly high rates of economic growth. If a country can get by with like 2 or 3%, you know, growth rates, it's doing pretty good, quite good, as a matter of fact, 7%. There were all kinds of reasons that that Russian economy was booming for those next dozen years or more. And so much of it had to do with, the dramatic increase of, or the restoration of, oil and natural gas production and selling on the world market. So much of it was in fact, it was primarily a result of that. But there were other factors as well. The point, folks, is that by the time of about 2012, 2013, 2014, certainly by 2012, when Vladimir Putin returned to the presidency, and again, he was president from 2000 until 2008, and then it was that period of 4 years where there was Dmitry Medvedev, who was president, and then Putin was the prime minister, and then they kind of switched seats in 2012, okay, that, if you play chess, you're familiar with the castling technique, and that's what they call it in Russia. The two kind of castle back and forth. And some say that even when Medvedev was president, from 2008 until 2012, and Putin was prime minister, that it was Putin who was still really in charge. And in a lot of ways, that was true. But the point is that when Putin returned to the presidency in 2012, that is where we begin to see a particularly active or increasingly active foreign policy on the part of Russia in terms of increasing initiatives, for example, in the Middle East, in Africa and in Latin America, other places as well, but in those in those countries, in terms of expanding Russian influence there, okay, in Cuba, in Venezuela, for example, in Bolivia, in Latin America, just to cite a few examples. The recent election in Mexico that was in July of this year, that it was clear that the Russian government favored the guy who ended up winning, this Andres Morales Lopez Obrador, right? AMLO, they call him, okay? Yeah, and he's kind of a leftist orientation, and at least in terms of his rhetoric, it was like, we're not going to be bullied by the U.S. and woof, 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 barking against, Trump and the U.S. and all this. And Russia was yeah, and encouraging all of that. This kind of activism and adventurism, we might say. And again, that was just a sample of the kind of increased activity of Russia. Well, the point is that, when Putin came back to the presidency, there was this... it wasn't 1999 anymore. Russia was now strong. Russia had a much different place and role in the world. And that enabled it, among other things, or that I suppose we could say served as the material foundation for the capacity of Russia to begin much more actively expanding its influence in the world. And that's exactly what it's tried to do. Does that include trying to undermine the Western alliance? Absolutely. As far as Russia is concerned, NATO exists for one reason and one reason only, and that is to keep Russia marginalized and contained and weak. In fact, President Putin, just as a little anecdote, he had mentioned to at the European Security Conference in 2008. This is Vladimir Putin, and he went on record saying this. He said, Russia will always respect the territorial integrity of Ukraine as long as there's no talk of Ukraine joining NATO, okay? Ukraine could even join the EU, and Russia's like, they didn't particularly welcome that, but, that would not have been a cause for the kind of interference, intervention, invasion, whichever word you want to use. You can all of them apply, I suppose. But that's what Putin said, 2008. We'll always respect the territorial integrity of Ukraine as long as there's no talk of Ukraine joining NATO. That's like it's their worst nightmare. And again, it's no accident that in the eastern portions, Donetsk and Luhansk, that those were the areas that were the most heavily industrialized of Ukraine. Those were the areas that, particularly in terms of military industrial capability, that those are the areas that Russia has effectively amputated from Ukraine. Those areas, incidentally, okay, and this is not an apology for Russian activism there since March of 2014, but those territories were historically part of Russia. Okay, well, back to this idea of Russia's insecurity, or not insecurity, but let's put it a little bit differently, and more politely, I suppose we could say, or respectfully from a Russian perspective, their sense of vulnerability, okay? If I may, let me cite from and with this I'll close up here, and forgive me for just kind of reading this verbatim. But this is the national security strategy of the Russian Federation. Okay, this is their most recent one, December of 2015. They updated every couple of years or so, but this is the current national security strategy of the Russian Federation in December of 2015. And they've got a whole bunch of different sections. It, it goes on for about, almost not quite 30 pages. And there's one section, section 43, called the main threats to state and public security of Russia. So in other words, when they look at the world, and this is the Putin administration, when they look at the world, what do they see as the main threats to the Russian state and to the security of the Russian public? And there are eight of them. Number one, intelligence and other activities by special services and organizations of foreign states. Don't mention any, okay? Elsewhere in that document, they do talk about, NATO, the United States, and so on. But number one, intelligence and other activities by special services and organizations of foreign states and individuals, such as George Soros, that causes harm to national interests. In other words, that there are these insidious foreign forces seeking to infiltrate and weaken and undermine and marginalize Russia, okay? That's the number one threat, okay? Number two, The activities, and it goes on and on and on, so I'll just give you a synopsis. The activities of terrorist and extremist organizations aimed at changing the constitutional order of the Russian Federation through violence, disrupting the operation of the organs of state power, destroying or disrupting the function of the military and industrial facilities, critical public infrastructures, and transport infrastructures, and then going on and on and on. What are they talking about here? Well, they're talking about the different, primarily, they don't mention them here, they mention them elsewhere in the document, of radical Islamic organizations. ISIS, we all know what ISIS is, right, yeah. ISIS considers Russia to be just as much an enemy to their aims and intentions of reestablishing an Islamic caliphate as the United States. The United States is kind of enemy number one just by virtue of our military and economic power in the world. But Russia is just as much of an enemy as far as they're concerned. As a matter of fact, so much Russia is, incidentally, Russia is about 21-22% Muslim. And do these Islamic terrorist groups act upon those things? They almost certainly do. The incidence of terrorism in Russia went up and up and up from 1992 until just a few years ago. And since then, the incidence of Islamic terrorism has gone down for a number of reasons. But that's certainly a main threat. Thirdly, okay, the activities of radical public associations and groups using nationalist and religious extremist ideology. In other words, just various extremist groups within Russia itself. Okay, and there are those there. I mean, I'm walking down the street in Moscow at times, and there's neo-Nazi groups out, passing out literature. It's crazy, but it's true. I don't think they represent, that much of a threat, but the potential is there. Number four, the activities of criminal organizations and groups, including transnational ones. In other words, just networks of international organized crime. The fourth on their list of national security threats to Russia, connected with illegal trade in narcotics, psychotropic substances, weapons, ammunition, explosive, organization of illegal migration and human trafficking. Russia has a worse drug problem than does the United States of America. That's hard for us to imagine. It's bad in this country. Okay, it's even worse in Russia. They've got a worse drug problem than we do here in the United States. And Russia considers that a major threat to their national security. Number five, activities connected with the use of information and communication technologies to disseminate and promote the ideologies of fascism, extremism, terrorism, and separatism. Okay. Sixthly, criminal offenses targeting individuals, property, the state authorities, a little bit of overlap in these, and so on. Seventh, major threat to Russian national security, corruption. The corruption within the state, and also corruption within the business sectors that are very often tied up with organized crime. Eight, in terms of the threats to national security, natural disasters, accidents, catastrophes, including those connected with global climate change, okay, the deterioration of the physical condition of Russia's infrastructure, and so on. Okay, these are what they consider to be the major threats. Now, what are the indicators? And with this, I'll close. Main indicators of Russia's national security, okay? And this may surprise some of us. Number one, okay? And they've got what? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. I'll be real quick with these. Number one, the main indicators of Russia's national security. Number one, we might think, how many tanks have they got? How many nuclear bombs have they got? First on their list of indicators of national security, the citizens' degree of satisfaction with the protection of their constitutional rights and freedoms and personal and property interests, including and against criminal infringements. In other words, to what degree the people are actually happy with the conditions in which they're living. That's the number one indicator of the degree to which Russian state and society are secure. That may shock us as Americans to read that. And again, how happy are they? Well, some are, some aren't. Number two, the proportion of the modern model of arms and military and special equipment in the Russian Federation armed forces. In other words, just basically military strength. Number three, indicator of their national security, life expectancy and per capita gross domestic product. Is the economy healthy? You can't have a strong, secure society that is economically decrepit. Next, okay, and this is going to sound a little pedantic, so bear with me. I'm just citing their document. The decile coefficient ratio of income of the most prosperous 10% of the Russian population to the least prosperous 10%. In other words, to what degree is it basically just like an underdeveloped country with a very, very few rich and most of the impoverished people? Okay. I have to put my professor hat on here for just a second, folks. But Aristotle's Politics, okay, which is 2,500 years old. Okay, according to Aristotle, okay, what makes for political stability in a good regime are three things. Number one, okay, mixed government. In other words, not, you know, what we call checks and balances. Number two, okay, practice and inculcation into the population and practice on the part of leaders and citizens of the four cardinal virtues in classical antiquity: wisdom, justice, courage, and moderation. So number one, mixed government. Number two, the four cardinal virtues. And number three, according to Aristotle, what makes for stability of government is not too much inequality within society. In other words, you cannot have a secure, stable society when you've got widening inequality. Russia recognizes that, you know, to their credit, okay? Okay, inflation. You can't have a secure society when, you know, the money's worthless or of less and less value. Unemployment. You can't have a secure society when you've got so many people unemployed. Proportion of the expenditure of the GDP on the development of science, technology, and education. How much money are they pouring into education as opposed to other things? Okay. The proportion of expenditure of GDP on culture. Okay. Yeah. And finally, the proportion of the territory of the Russian Federation not conforming to environmental standards. That's the degree, or the indicator of how secure the society is. Just, are they taking care of their environment? And, you know, it's an interesting reckoning of what makes for a secure society. So at any rate, that's kind of what Russia's up to in the world, and those, it seems to me, are some of the core ideas, you know, animating what they're doing. As far as they're concerned, Russia's rightful role and place as the world is not in this domineering kind of role, but just to serve as this stabilizing force for peace in the world. That's the Russian narrative. So, okay, thank you for your attention.
Thank you for the opportunity to ask a question. You speak of these documents laying out the principles and your core belief around being a democratic society, corruption, income disparity. And yet when we look at the Putin regime, there's been a lot of evidence presented around pretext for attacks on foreign countries such as Georgia, Ukraine, pretext for perhaps intervention in Chechnya with the apartment building bombings. There's been a lot of evidence around corruption, a lot of evidence around policies that increase income disparity. How do you square that with what they've laid out? I mean,
sure.
Is that something that you
sure.
see as consistent?
Yeah. Excellent question. No, I don't see it as consistent at all. I see it as grossly disconcordant that, to their credit, Russia freely admits that they've got a massive problem with corruption, for example. One might say, well, you know, they're actually part of the problem. You know, you've got the fox guarding the hen house, so to speak. And that is true. The other side of that coin, and again, I can just kind of speak from my own sort of, you know, personal experiences there. Let me just give you a counterexample of that, okay? One of the major organizations, in fact, the major organization in Russia that sort of tracks incidents of what we would call hate crimes, okay? In other words, like anti-Semitism or, you know, lynchings or something like that, something like the Jewish, Anti-Defamation League. It's something like that. It's called SOVA. And in fact, I know the guy, he's a friend of mine who's the head of it. He started in 2002. And it's an organization in Russia that tracks incidents of hate crimes, extremism, and so on, and also tracks cases where the government, you know, ends up pursuing people on the pretext of extremism, but it's just they're trying to just get rid of a political enemy, and they're pretty much not only are they allowed to freely operate, but the head of SOVA, again, I know this guy, his name's Alexander Verkhovsky. He's an interesting guy. He's about this tall, and he looks like Rasputin. He's an interesting character, but that's kind of beside the point. Putin recently appointed, Verkhovsky to be on his, you know, panel for improving like human rights conditions in Russia. Now, human rights conditions in Russia are not good. I mean, they're, in fact, they're, by all evidence that we have, you know, they've kind of deteriorated under Putin. And, you know, is Putin responsible for that? Well, you know, in the final analysis, I think we'd have to say yes. So, you know, there is this tension, you know, between, you know, their stated ideals and, you know, the actual reality. The other incident or the cases that you mentioned of the, you know, the invasion of Georgia in August of 2008, you know, and the amputation of those two territories, you know, Abkhazia and South Ossetia, you know, that Russia recognizes as independent countries. There's only four other countries in the world that recognize them as independent countries. Nobody else does. In fact, the U.S. State Department, the United Nations, the European Union all recognize those as being, you know, still part of the Republic of Georgia. How does one square that with, you know, Russia's claim to be operating within the confines of international law and so on? Well, I don't think it can be squared. You know, it's just a case of Russia saying one thing and doing something else. So I don't know. Did that help or did that answer your question? So, yeah. You know, it's, you say it's kind of hypocritical or two-faced, and yeah, I think it is. I don't think you can get around it, you know. You know, the just one more thing, and I'll go on. Like Crimea, for example, okay. Crimea, I was in Russia right after annexed Crimea. And, you know, they did so, at least in terms of the, you know, perfunctory kind of process, on the basis of a referendum that they held, right, in the end of March of 2014, in which the majority of people of Crimea voted in favor of, you know, breaking off with Ukraine and joining up with Russia. Russia said repeatedly, you know, and the Western world howled in protest, and, you know, the European Union howled in protest, and Ukrainian government certainly howled in protest. And Russia said, well, what's the difference between that and the referendum in Scotland, for example, that was held in September of 2014? It was no difference as far as Russia was concerned. Well, in actual fact, there was a lot of difference. Okay, for one thing, the government of Great Britain, you know, approved that referendum, right, or that plebiscite, really, in Scotland. The Ukrainian government didn't approve, didn't even come close to approving the referendum to, you know, for Crimea's secession from Ukraine and joining up with Russia. So, you know, there are some ways in which, you know, what they offer has a, you know, a veneer of plausibility, but if you dig down into the details, it, you know, it doesn't carry water. Okay. No, and I was in Russia at the time, and people seemed genuinely puzzled. Just like, what the hell are they giving us a hard time about this for? You know, because in Scotland they're having a referendum, and, you know, the Scots chose to stay with Great Britain, the Crimeans you know, 77% of which were ethnic Russians anyway, you know, so, and it had been part of Russia ever since, from 1954 when Khrushchev transferred it to Ukraine. So why in the Western world? Do you see what I'm saying? Okay. Yeah. I don't know if that answered your question, but that's the best I can do. Okay. Oh, geez, hands everywhere. Yes, sir, in the white shirt over here, I think that your hand went up next.
And by the way, thank you for a terrific lecture. My question is simply to ask you to elucidate or elaborate upon what you said about Russia desiring a multipolar and a polycentric view of the world. When I hear those terms, I think of a couple of things. I think of 19th century Europe with competing medium-sized powers. I also think of spheres of influence, geographically speaking, around the world. And so I wonder if Russia is thinking more about the one or the other, or something else indeed. And I wonder, if it's the latter, should we be worried about that as much as we're worried about China believing it has a natural sphere of influence?
Mm-hmm. No, that's an excellent question. And again, the you know, when they redid their foreign policy concept in 2008 after the Georgian War, in which they amputated those two regions from Georgia, that particular iteration of the foreign policy concept addressed these kind of concerns. And frankly, it did advocate something like a spheres of influence sort of vision of the world. And you know, those, so if it looked like they were kind of moving in that direction, you know, I think they were. And again, that was under President Medvedev. And you know, I'm sure Putin had his hand in that as well. In fact, he was the one that, you know, flew from China back to Moscow to oversee the invasion of Georgia. But yeah, that was very much their thinking, and the idea of a, you know, a multipolar polycentric world is that there are sort of these kind of natural spheres of influence. You say, well, but, and then one could come back and say, well, wait a minute, you know, if that's the case, why are they, you know, going out of their way to project so much influence in Latin America and stoking anti-American sentiment there, which they certainly are, which one could say is doubly hypocritical in light of the fact, and most of my experience is that most Americans aren't aware of the fact, that the Monroe Doctrine, okay, that was, you know, promulgated in, what, 1823, President Monroe, obviously, that the idea of that came from Russian Tsar Alexander I. Yeah, it was true. I mean, he was the one that encouraged the American administration to project American power as much as possible in order to keep the other Europeans' powers, you know, influence in this part of the world at a minimum. And the reason for that, in terms of the grand historical scheme of things, was because of this ongoing rivalry or intensifying rivalry between Russia and Great Britain. And one way of countering British power was to encourage American power. There's this view that we've always been had hostile relations with Russia and the United States, and that is not true. It's not true. I mean, the U.S. and Russia mutually recognized each other in 1809, and from that time until the Russian Revolution, U.S.-Russian relations were very, very good, oddly enough, you know. A question here, then a question there. Sorry. Yes, sir. Yeah.
Again, thank you for a fantastic, fantastic lecture. You know, you made me realize again, treating them as this super enemy of ours, you brought a little more knowledge into it, that they're not as crazy or as bad or as dangerous as they are. One thing to me that I cannot understand, like you indicated the economics, where all of a sudden, you know, Russia was doing okay, and then all of a sudden it started collapsing. So it was pretty good under a total socialist communist system, and they were okay. And then what started them falling down so much?
Actually, it wasn't okay under the communist socialist system. I mean, by the time of Gorbachev's launching of his perestroika or his economic reforms in 1986, by that time, the Soviet economy had effectively stopped growing. Okay, the growth rates had slowed to single digits by the end of the 1970s, and then into the early 1980s, they were just about close to zero, and by the time that Gorbachev was appointed General Secretary in 1985, they were effectively at zero. In other words, the Soviet economy, in other words, one could say that the innate maladaptiveness and dysfunctionality of that Soviet economy just got worse and worse and worse as time went on. Okay. And again, there are all sorts of reasons for that. You know, the shorthand explanation for that is that Soviet model of economic growth, it worked pretty well for the stages of economic growth that they were at in the 19-teens and 1920s and 1930s. In other words, this powerful state marshaling all these resources in a hyper-dictatorial kind of way. You can do that, you know, at that level of industrialization. Once you get at a more mature level of industrialization, you cannot run an economy that way. What you need is innovation and openness and so on. And those were the virtues that were conspicuously absent in that Soviet. So the problem was that Soviet system, it was barely functional by the time of the middle 80s, and then Gorbachev's reforms, just in a word, or a few words, what they did was they didn't produce the effect of a transition to a more market economy. They held on to some of the worst aspects of the old system, and the result was 10 years of economic catastrophe for Russia. I mean, that's kind of the short answer.
Yeah, I think my question follows up where you were. When the Soviet Union was breaking up, you know, I'm thinking back to the Reagan years and the rhetoric that was going on in this country. And then during the 90s, I just wonder, do you think the United States and NATO missed an opportunity to encourage a different kind of Russia that might have been more democratic? You know, if they had maybe supported the Westernizers more, maybe have come in with advice and aid, would we have a different Russia today?
Personally, I am of the opinion that the short answer to that question is yes. And I tend to agree with many of you in this room have probably heard of George Kennan, right, who's written extensively about Russia. He was a U.S. ambassador to Russia and so on. He was the intellectual author of that doctrine of containment. Right? Yeah. Kennan was, and he was very, very old by the time of the 1990s, but he was still, you know, mentally very, very sharp and not hesitant of offering his opinion. He argued repeatedly that eastward expansion of NATO was a colossal mistake. That it was a colossal mistake. In fact, he wrote a famous editorial. It was more than an editorial. It was like an op-ed piece, an expanded op-ed piece in the New York Times. I think it was 96 or 97 or something, in which he argued that expanding NATO eastward was just about the worst thing that the Western world could do for precisely the reasons that, you know, are kind of implied in your question, okay? Yeah, that what it would do was just bring out those worst impulses of insecurity, latent impulses perhaps, in Russia. And Russia to this day claims, the Western world denies it, but Russia claims that in 1990, they were basically given promises that if they disbanded the Warsaw Treaty Organization, that there would not be a Western expansion of NATO. Now, the Western world, led by the United States, you know, claims that they never offered any such promise whatsoever. That's a matter, I suppose, of, you know, historiographical dispute. But Russia, to Russia, it's just axiomatic that this eastward expansion of NATO, despite the Western world's alleged promises not to do so, is just one more example of the way in which the Western world cannot be trusted, in the same way they couldn't trust Hitler after signing the 1939 Anti-Aggression Pact. You know, they couldn't trust Napoleon. They couldn't trust Charles XII of Sweden. They, you know, you go on and name the list of invaders of Russia. And now its current incarnation was NATO, with this relentless drive eastward and NATO's wooing of Georgia and Ukraine and perhaps even Armenia, you know, to join NATO as well. I think it was a mistake. That's my own personal view. I mean, a couple of years ago, I was in a panel down in Washington, D.C. with former Secretary of Defense Cohen you know, remember Senator Cohen, who became Secretary of Defense Cohen. He was Secretary of Defense in that during that time. In fact, the second Clinton administration. And, you know, Secretary Cohen and I just obviously have a very, very different interpretation of that. You know, Cohen's view is that that eastward expansion of NATO was nothing but good for Eastern Europe and for European security. And I personally think it was a lost opportunity. It's my own personal view.
Thank you for a terrific lecture. I wonder if maybe your lecture should have been not what is Russia up to, but what is Putin up to? I'm not sure he has Russia's interest at heart as much as he does his own. Our Treasury Department 2 years ago said he's amassed a fortune of about $300 billion, probably the richest man in the world, running a criminal oligarchy. Russia basically is a huge gas station run by Putin and the Russian mafia. But he's successful in achieving his objectives. And he has gotten a person elected president whose one major objective was, let's shut down NATO, which is a Putin objective. Why it's a Trump objective, I'm not sure. Trump is saying other things that tie right in with Putin's objectives. So Putin must feel like he's the greatest political theorist and organizer in the last 100 years. So the question is Putin really interested in Russia, or is Putin interested in enriching himself? And maybe he's been successful in getting a Russian agent put into the White House.
Sure. Okay, excellent question. You know, I mean, personally, I don't think he's got a Russian agent in the White House. However, you know, the argument that you know, that there's something profoundly, you know, disconnected between, you know, President Putin and his personal ambitions, right, and the interests and ambitions of Russia as a whole, that there's something terribly incongruous or discordant about that. You know, that doesn't seem to be the majority view within Russia itself. However, the number of, and I know this probably won't answer your question, I'm just, you know, blah, blah, giving you an academic answer, okay? that view that you enunciated is certainly not uncommon among observers of Russia and Russian affairs in the world. For example, okay, in this little stack of books I brought in, there's a Dutch scholar by the name of, and you'll love this book, okay? And it's called Putin's Wars, The Rise of Russia's New Imperialism. It's by a Dutch scholar by the name of Marcel van Herpen. And it's you know, he's one of these guys that, you know, it's like the book of the month club, you know, it's a new month, he's got a new book out, okay? And he's just extraordinarily prolific, but, you know, outstanding scholarship, just sort of meticulously documenting, you know, Putin's rise to power, the projection of power. Well, I can get one for you. I'll give you my email address. Okay. Yeah. But that's very much the view of van Herpen. That's the view of, you know, a lot of other observers as well. And frankly, that is the view of the westernizers within Russia, such as, you know, Lilia Shevtsova and others who are here, that, you know, that Putin is basically running a mafia state. In fact, I have a good friend. He lives in Old Town, Maine, and he is a former GRU agent. You know, the GRU, you know, there was the KGB and the GRU. The GRU was kind of those sort of military intelligence, and he was a former GRU agent, and he basically got disgruntled with the whole system when the USSR fell apart. He took off out of the country, and I have him come in and speak to my students every semester, you know, and he's very forthright. He says, as far as he's concerned, you know, Russia is nothing but a criminal mafia state. And, you know, that's the opinion of my friend Alex, the former GRU agent, and you know, I think his vitriol even exceeds that of van Herpen and others of the sort. You know, and there's doubtless a certain element of truth in that. Let me, if I may, just give you a little anecdote. Last year, about this time, my wife Aurora and I were over in Eastern Europe, and we spent about a week in Ukraine, in Kiev. And you know, I mean, I know Russian pretty well. In fact, I'm sometimes mistaken for one because on my dad's side, you know, they're Slavic folks, you know, and all that. But you know, my Russian's pretty good, and you know, I can understand Ukrainian and speak a little bit if I have to. But you know, I detected almost no hostility in Kiev against Russians. In fact, none at all, none at all. And I talked to a lot of people. Just vitriolic dislike. I mean, and even that's putting it mildly, of Putin. Okay, and that's precisely the prevailing view there, is that it's that the SOB Putin, you know, that's responsible for all of this. He and his criminal mafia gang, this, you know, stoking of conflict in Donbass and or of Donetsk and Luhansk, you know, the amputation of Crimea and so on. It just struck me as, maybe it shouldn't have, but it did. It just struck me as interesting in the extreme, you know, that there was, I mean, almost not a sliver of anti-Russian sentiment, you know. In other words, you know, those Russian SOBs, you know, they've done this and they've done that. Do you see what I'm saying? You know, yeah, and, you know, so, yeah, is it a, you know, criminal mafia kind of regime? Well, Putin certainly, has he amassed a fortune? He most certainly has, you know. So, yeah. I don't know if that answered your question at all, but yes, okay. Yes, sir. Yeah.
I just wondered to what degree the military has any role in formulation of policy in the Soviet Union or in Russia. And one of the reasons I ask that is because they are well aware that there's a demographic problem and the health issues in Russia, rampant tuberculosis, rampant AIDS, rampant drug abuse, which makes it actually difficult for them to recruit healthy military personnel. And I imagine that also would have some impact on their technological development. So I just wondered what you thought about that. And I wanted to thank you for this great insight into the various strands of Russian thinking.
It's a good question. I'm not sure if I can offer any commentary on it that will be very useful or insightful. I will say this, though, that and this is kind of a backup to be able to offer any useful commentary to your question, that during the days of the USSR, in fact, in 1977, Brezhnev created this thing called the National Security Council. It wasn't part of the formal constitutional machinery, but every single high-level defector from the former USSR said one and the same thing, and that was that by the time even the latter 70s, let alone in the 1980s, that it was this National Security Council that really made the decisions, and it was populated mostly by the upper echelons of the military. Okay, yeah, it was the head of the KGB was there as well, head of the MVD. We don't have anything like the MVD. It's the Ministry of Internal Affairs. I know we have an interior ministry, but that's not what their MVD is. But they were part of this National Security Council. And it seems to me that under both Yeltsin and especially under Putin, that they have gone out of their way to make sure that the military is subordinate, okay, to that highest echelon of civilian rule. Does that mean the military doesn't have any, influence in Russian policy? No, it doesn't mean that at all. I mean, they most certainly do. But Putin has been notorious for just kind of cleaning house, among the upper echelons of the officer corps and also in the upper bureaucracy when he finds pockets of resistance. The guy who's written more about this stuff and kind of the prevailing American expert on this stuff is a guy by the name of Brian Taylor. He's a professor of political science out at Syracuse University, and he's probably written more about this than anybody. And that I think is Taylor's grand conclusion as well, that the military, it's influential, but nowhere near what it was in last days of the USSR. So,
thank you very much for your lecture. We didn't talk a whole lot about the culture, and I was wondering, is that out of your discussion or?
No.
Or?
In fact, most of the stuff I've published has been about the role of the Russian Orthodox Church and church and state and all this.
Exactly.
Stuff.
Yeah. So that's my question. Yeah. My understanding is that they are okay or accepting of the Russian Orthodox Church, mm-hmm. but what's their view on Christianity and Judaism? They mm-hmm. used to be a lot of Russian Jews.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. No. Good question. Putin, in fact, all three, every one of these three documents that I mentioned here—the foreign policy concept, the national security strategy, and the doctrine of information security—argues that the taproot, okay, for a healthy society, is the positive elements in the deepest religious traditions of Judaism, of Christianity, and Islam, okay, and that those need to be, that on the one hand, it's a secular state. In other words, there's a separation of religion and politics in a formal, constitutional, juridical, legal kind of way. But on the other hand, that that these, positive elements of religious tradition, okay, or religion-derived culture, not only are they good for society, but they're indispensable. Okay, and that in fact, in this doctrine of the information security of the Russian Federation, there's a whole section. I mean, I got a copy of the document. I'd be happy to give it to you. But there's a whole section there where they talk about these nefarious, insidious influences of outside powers, okay, and then in other places they mention specifically the Western world and the United States, to undermine the vitality and strength of Russia by undermining the traditional moral values that derive from primarily the Christian religion, but also from Judaism and Islam as well, and good Islam. There's bad Islam, you know, the radicals they don't like, and they're at war with them. But, you know, so as far as the Putin administration is concerned, you know, religion and religion-derived morality is absolutely crucial for a healthy society, oddly enough. Okay. And, you know, there's been this sort of condominium between President Putin and the Orthodox Church. You know, he claims to meet with a spiritual advisor, you know, a couple times a week, right? You know, a Russian Orthodox priest and so on. So, okay, folks, thank you very much for your attention. Have a good night.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's speaker was James Warhala, professor of political science at the University of Maine. He recently spoke at the Claremont Hotel in Southwest Harbor, discussing Russian foreign policy in the 21st century. We have an extended version of this program, concluding with a question and answer period, available on our website, mainepublic.org. Just click radio to find this program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock and Ulrich Schnaus. Charles Beck is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and Speaking in Maine is edited by me, Roddy Nickpour. Thanks for joining us.